Take a network break, steep a hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we take a pleasant summer stroll through this week's tech news. I'm your host, Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. And we also have a special guest today, John Free, for more insights and strategy. And before we jump into the news, I want to thank today's sponsor, Mellanox. Mellanox is redesigning the modern data center with Ethernet switches that provide twice the benefits in half the space at half the cost. And for a limited time only, get up to half off the price. Check out their website for more details at mellanox.com. All right, so let's dive right in. This was a week of acquisitions. Let's kick it off with Oracle. They announced that they're buying NetSuite for almost $10 billion. NetSuite does ERP software via software as a service, and it gives Oracle a nicely established foothold in the cloud. NetSuite actually recently reported its own second quarter earnings. The company did see revenue go up 30% versus last year. That's pretty good, but it's actually still losing money. They had a net loss of $37.7 million in the second quarter, and that's actually more than they lost Q2 last year, which was $32.3 million.
Yeah, if you can't win customers, you can buy them.
Right. I guess that's what's happening.
But
it all depends on the kind of customers that you want to buy.
Yeah, well, that's where the value comes in, is if you're buying a customer who's actually got something that you can sell them, won something you can sell them.
Right. You don't want to buy the same customers you already have.
No. Well, no, maybe you do if you want to increase your market share. So if you're interested in increasing market share instead of, so that you can just crowd your competitors out and get into like a monopoly position and build a moat around your position, sure, you might want to go and buy some customers. But in this case, it's about buying someone else's customers so you can call it growth, I think.
Yeah, Oracle's definitely trying to grow its revenue from cloud services. Apparently, there's a little race between them and Salesforce to see who can hit the $10 billion revenue mark first. Also, this is kind of a little bit of an incestuous acquisition because NetSuite was born, created by an ex-Oracle executive, and Larry Ellison happens to be the largest shareholder in NetSuite. He owns nearly 40% of the company's shares. And with the price that Oracle is paying for NetSuite, that's a pickup of $3.5 billion for Larry Ellison.
Like he needs it.
Yeah,
like,
and I gotta wonder, isn't the board or some regulatory body gonna say, "Oh, wait a minute, maybe we should look at this"?
But don't you think, to some degree, that when you see these two companies like this, where somebody sprung out from another, do you think that maybe Larry was investing early on, thinking, it's way easier than doing it myself, is to go see if I can get it running in the market, and then if it works well, I can buy it back, and if it doesn't, oh well, I lost my investment.
I think you're attributing too much intelligence. I think one of his buddies from Oracle said, "I want to go and give this idea. Can you help me out?" And that's what he's done. He's funded one of his buddies. It's much more likely to be led by that than, "I want to get a double down on the cloud." I don't think Oracle's actually all that serious about the cloud. Or maybe it was 8 to 10 years ago when Oracle dreamed of doing cloud before everybody else did. It's a $10 billion business, right? So it would take 10 years to get that large. So maybe back when Oracle was doing, remember they were the first people to do thin client and talk about the cloud with their Java clients and all that sort of stuff?
Oh, yeah, network computers.
Yeah. We should do more of that because this is a networking podcast in name, not so much in content this week.
Not this week. All right, well, let's carry on. We've got some other acquisition news. The other big story was Verizon. Apparently, they looked under their couch cushions. They came up with a $4.8 billion to acquire poor old Yahoo, or at least parts of Yahoo. They're going to get the internet business, that's search, email, and portals like Yahoo Sports, Yahoo Finance, and some assets like Tumblr.
It's amazing how much money there is in ads.
Yes, I guess so.
Because remember a while ago they bought AOL's media division. Verizon bought AOL Media, and that was an ad tech buy again. The general suggestion is that Verizon is trying to get control of the ad industry. This gives them a 4.4% market share compared to Google, which is 35%, and Facebook, which is roughly 35%. And Verizon wants to get in on ad tech because it thinks it's got the mojo for that. I'm not sure I agree, but,
Yeah, well, they certainly can collect a lot of information about their users and this, the assets that Yahoo has, even though Yahoo hasn't been a shining star for a long time, they still do actually get traffic.
Yeah, but between AOL and Yahoo, they've spent over $9 billion buying into these pieces. At what point could you have maybe developed some of those things yourself? So I kind of wonder, they want to be a pipe vendor. They also want to be able to sell what's running through the pipe. And usually you do a better job if you can focus on one of the two. I haven't seen too many people really tie the two together and make a go at both of them.
Well, I think in this case it's ad tech. So now a Verizon can look at the data moving through the pipes and extract metadata about you as a person. They know where you are, what sort of things you're looking at from the network, not just from tracking you as you move around the web. And they can bring that to AOL. So Yahoo and AOL and AOL purchases are very centric in North America. That's where they're most of the customer, you know, the vast majority, 60 to 80% of the users are. And so now Verizon can, in theory, target ads better than anybody else because they can see your traffic crossing their mobile network or their internet backbones or their DSLs or, you know, fiber to the curbs. And they can serve better ads at a higher rate than, say, Google or Facebook, who just have to guess because Verizon's got access to metadata, the better metadata than the other people do. And I think that's where the money is. That's what they're hoping for.
Yeah, based on what I've read, Verizon is aiming to be number three in the ad market behind Google and Facebook. And there's enough money there that number three is pretty good.
It's especially good if you're number three and you happen to be the only, you know, quote unquote, true carrier at this point in that top three. Google and Facebook are carriers to some degree, but Verizon puts itself in a different category because it truly does own much more of the infrastructure.
There's right. some interesting speculation. Could Facebook and Google move into owning the internet backbone as a way of getting more metadata about its users? I mean, both of those companies are hungry to get more and more data on their users. And the only thing they can do at the moment is track you at the endpoint. But they're missing a major part of the picture. What else is it that you're doing? I mean, what are you doing at work? I mean, Microsoft bought LinkedIn so it gets insights into what you're doing in your professional activities to know who your connections are and to get your history and your resume and all that sort of stuff. Maybe Google and Facebook need to start buying up carriers. That would be an interesting turnaround, do you think?
Well, they're already trying to do things, you know, overseas. I think both Google and Facebook have trial projects where they're trying to provide wireless broadband service to users with like dirigibles and floating platforms and so on.
Yeah, but those things, those are interesting, but until you get a big fat pipe somewhere and you can start to aggregate a lot of traffic from a lot of different sources, it doesn't really pay off. But if anybody had the ability, and I think when you look at a lot of what Facebook is doing, a lot of the things that they've done have made it look like they're more like a carrier these days. And Lord knows Google has the footprint to be able to do some things like that. But you got to figure out the business model. You know, that's the challenge.
Well, I guess if you look at what, you know, Facebook did recently with Larry releasing an open source model for mobile networking, and they've also done a lot to produce carrier class equipment to reduce the cost of bandwidth. And Google's been out there putting Google Fiber down. And that strategy most people would see as reducing the cost of WAN bandwidth by threatening to cut the game, right? Change the way it works. Instead of relying on your monopoly position to just go and use commoditized equipment and use smart software to change the way it works. What if Google and Facebook say they've already built up muscle and experience, you know, they've had some cuts around competing in those monopoly telco markets. And what if they suddenly start to say, well, we need to own the network too to capture all that metadata? It's not a big step if they've already taken these baby steps around hardware and architecture and how do you run a big network. They've got the capability. They've certainly got the financial muscle. They've got the motivation to get more metadata, to do more for their people. And they've also got some experience about competing head on with those carriers. It could work, I guess, if it comes together.
Yeah, I mean, we've got Google Fiber here in Austin, Texas, and it's great. I don't use Google Fiber, but it's managed to bump my bandwidth up and drop the cost. Competition is good. And so if you're Google, maybe you put Google Fiber in as a way to start to drop some of those costs in different markets before you go in for the big kill.
It's also a way to build exposure in a market too, right? So if you've, you know, Google Fiber, they'll end up with a business unit that'll have, you know, thousands of employees. Now, sure, Verizon, you know, and Comcast have these hundreds of thousands of employees and trucks and base stations and all that sort of stuff. But it's not impossible that they could move into that market as a decision. Certainly in North America, where that's a very unique market that's effectively monopolized. The government has like got a communist control, sweetheart deal between the telcos and the government. It's a very communist-style business model there. It's not actually open or competitive.
No, not at all. And if Google can use what they're doing to drive down some of those infrastructure costs, it makes it easier for them to get into the market. Quite frankly, they don't need to own everything. They just need to be able to tap into that pipe and have access to that pipe. They might be better off not owning it.
Well, my point is that if they did own it, then they could actually get more metadata out of the network itself. They could start doing network inspection and monitor people's traffic flows and flow data.
All right, we went off the rails a little bit there with some speculation on Google when we were talking about Verizon. But just to bring it back a little bit, Verizon is leaving some parts of Yahoo on the table, including some very valuable parts. That's Yahoo's holdings in Alibaba, which is a Chinese internet giant, and Yahoo Japan. These holdings are worth around $40 billion. From what I've read, these assets are going to be rebranded and become actually a separate investment business.
Not bad when you sell the actual business title for $5 billion and there's around $40 billion worth of shares left.
Right.
They don't do anything. They don't have any employees. There'll be a couple of accountants in an office going, how much did the shares go up today? Check.
That's right.
Tick a box. Move on.
No. I want to be CEO of that company.
That's right. So Yahoo did deals in the past where they took investments in, tried to get into China. They did a joint venture deal when the Chinese government was big on, as I've always been big on joint ventures. And they have a couple of other investments where they own shares in other companies. Yahoo itself didn't run them. They were just investments. And $40 billion left, even though the core assets of Yahoo are sold. So yay for them. Don't forget she's got a $57 million severance package. So if they give her the boot, they've got to pay out. So she wins either way. She either manages a portfolio with none of the nerds, right? Gets rid of all the nerds and all the websites and all the ugly parts and just sits around and watches the share price go up and down on these investments. And if they kick her out, she gets a $57 million. Thank you very much. It's been great having you.
Yes, that's CEO yeah. Marissa Mayer you're referring to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where's the downside in all of that?
Yes. Certainly no downside for the executives.
Can I have some of that downside?
I want to know how it is that these executives of public companies get away with deals like this. Isn't anybody paying attention?
It's become a thing to try and overpay CEOs. Did you see the report this week that the highest paid CEOs are the worst performing?
Because there are literally no incentives for them to do a good job, that they're going to get a golden parachute regardless of what they do.
Oh, listen to him. He's on the phone. My goodness, we've hit the punch button on Drew.
I've got my pitchfork right here in my hand. The torch is soaking in oil. I'm just waiting for somebody to come by with a lighter. And
there was some research published this week. I'll drop a link into the show notes here, that CEOs who get paid the most actually run the worst performing companies. just in case you think it's not true, it is actually true, and it's actually proven by some research that was actually done. So there you go. If your CEO is overpaid, you're probably time to leave and find a better employer.
I was going to say, or become a CEO. I mean, that's your other option.
Apparently,
you don't have to be a good one either.
Yeah, but then you'd have to like do weird stuff, like talk to people and like know nothing, and just spend your life on the telephone chatting to people. That wouldn't be much fun.
No.
No,
that's what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
But we're good at this, right?
Yeah, it's about all I'm good at. Yeah.
As you mean, that's why we're not making the money that other executives are, because we're good at this.
Well, you could work for Cisco. I mean, one of the things that Cisco's shareholders are getting all complained about is how much stock options are issued to Cisco executives. And there's another round of whining this week about just how much of Cisco's share buybacks get issued to staff, which then get bought back later on as the staff sell them. It's a very interesting discussion. So it may actually apply not just to CEOs, but all the way down the food chain.
All right. I'm going to set that aside for one now. We've got a couple more acquisitions to talk about. A10 Networks, they make application delivery controllers, firewalls, and other networking products. They're acquiring Apcito. Apcito's got a suite of services, including application delivery and security, and they're targeting cloud and microservices applications. Terms of the deal weren't disclosed as we were recording. But A10, they compete with F5 and Citrix. We've been talking a long time about the transition away from hardware to software. Do you guys feel like A10 is stealing a march on its competitors by grabbing up sort of a cloud and microservices-oriented ADC company?
Well, I would say generally there's a lot of activity in this area, and there's a lot of people looking to kind of get their foothold as there's a lot of change to the cloud. So, you know, basically A10 had a build or buy decision, and they decided they could get there quicker by buying, but that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of other people out there in this area. What they've got is kind of a time to market movement, but there's going to be a lot. I think you'll see bigger names in this area start to come out, and that's all I can say on that.
So I agree with that point. I think what you're also seeing here is the fact that load balancers as such actually have little value going forward, and the companies whom have load balancers, F5 has a similar problem, Riverbed and A10. They all have problems about how do they keep their devices relevant. So what you have is this situation going forward where they have to make these, you know, appliances which are in line. They're in critical positions in the network. So they've got control of customers. They've got moats that prevent, you know, customers from leaving them. And so they've been working out that they can put security into the load balancer. F5 particularly has been very successful selling cloud security. And A10 needs to step up here and give it some stuff. So what it's done is built a provisioning portal to help smooth out the operational part. So I see Apcedo as a web scale application delivery so that you can actually start to use your load balancer for analytics and a portal for configuration as well as policy base. So it's an SDNization of the load balancer / application delivery market. And we'll talk more about an acquisition that Riverbed's just done in the market, which shows you the where you go from here. And then we'll talk a little bit more about F5's results further down in the show.
I was going to say, one of the things that you will see is there's a lot of opportunity right now simply because you just mentioned SDN, but NFV, Network Function Virtualization, you're finding that a lot of these physical appliances that people used to have are starting to get replaced slowly by virtualized network functions. And that's a natural inflection point where if I'm a customer and I've got to move from physical devices to now virtual devices, I'm going to go out, I'm going to re-architect things, I'm going to buy in. So there's an opportunity to go grab customers as people make that transition. And that's why I think it was real important for A10 to get out there and move quickly, because there's going to be a lot of disruption, a lot of change over the next couple of years with customers. And, you know, this may be one of those once every 20 years kind of changes as people start to move to these virtualized functions from physical appliances.
Hmm. Would you, one of the things that I think I'm seeing is that you're seeing SDN platforms like VMware's NSX or Cisco's ACI actually absorb other people's products inside of their platform, so that you no longer think of you're working with F5, you're using Cisco's, like Cisco and their the Cisco ACI business unit with their Clicker strategy, and there's other parts of Cisco doing the same sort of thing, right? ACI is competing with the other parts of Cisco here for the automation part. And I think a lot of these load balancer vendors are realizing they have to build their own SDN platforms to try and keep people from eating their lunch. So in the sense that this allows you to do auto-provisioning, so for example, NSX recently bought RV Networks, which is a variable, you know, a software-based load balancer that scales horizontally. That suddenly changes the way things look, because VMware has now got a load balancer as part of its networking strategy.
Well, you've got a couple dynamics going on there. One is obviously Cisco doing what they do, but you know, you talk to customers and ACI stands for all Cisco infrastructure. And so they built a great strategy, and there are a lot of people who are just wedded to the Cisco world, and this will be fine for them. And same with VMware. There are customers who are very happy with VMware and love everything that VMware does, but you talk to any customer and their big goal for the next 5 years is, how do I get out of VMware? What, do I move to OpenStack? Do I move to public cloud? They want to change the dynamics. So as these guys bring all these things into their platforms, it makes them really appealing, but it doesn't break the dynamic of, I don't like one guy to own all this stuff. But then you got the other end of the spectrum, which is there's a lot of open source things. And I was just out at OPNFV in Berlin a couple weeks ago, and there's a lot of momentum there, especially around these network functions that are getting virtualized. But you know, one of the challenges there is you're somewhat kind of building it all yourself. So I think the window is open right now for Cisco and VMware, but I don't know how long that window stays open, because some of these other things that are coming on the side might make it more appealing. And most of the guys looking at network virtualization are trying to figure out, how do I get away from this single vendor that runs everything for me that I'm beholden to?
Yeah, I can certainly agree with that. So to me, it's the interaction between, you know, load balance and network firewall was all neatly siloed out for the last 20 years. And SDN comes along and changes everything. And now we're looking at a completely different roadmap, like the way things are structured. And I think, you know, that's kind of where and some companies are using it as a land grab to go and, you know, take out the competitors, and other companies are going out there to, you know, protect their turf or to, you know, form new partnerships. So like you say, it's all up for grabs.
Yeah, it's all up for grabs. And what's the dynamic that's really changing all that is what's happening with east-west traffic. I mean, we lived for 20, 25 years in a world of everything's north-south, and suddenly all this east-west is coming in. And that's what's really, it's causing people to rethink the way they do things, and that's what opens up for these guys. But it is a land grab more than anything else.
And of course, public cloud is eating any growth that might have existed in the enterprise IT space at the same time.
Oh yeah, because the biggest competitor to your IT department is Amazon.
I actually saw it as Azure, but yeah. I think Amazon's only taken away from startups, like the next generation of companies who are starting today. Poor people, you know.
No. Amazon is taking away from. Amazon is the shadow IT. Microsoft with Azure is, you know, corporate sanctioned cloud.
Okay, that makes sense. That's a good split. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, Amazon's where you go when you want to hide away. Azure's where you go if the IT department does it.
Yeah, if the IT sanctions it, you go to Microsoft. If IT isn't sanctioning it, they're not moving fast enough, you go to Amazon.
That's a pretty broad brush, but I can go with it.
I'm good with broad brushes.
So we had mentioned Riverbed briefly. They are also in our acquisition roundup here. They're buying a small company called Aeternity. Aeternity focuses on end user monitoring for end user experience. They've got solutions for a public and private cloud. They're an agent-based model. This complements Riverbed's Steel Central App Response. That's an agentless network-based app performance monitoring product. So I think Riverbed has an opportunity to slot Aeternity right in here. It gives it an agent. They get that full, complete end-to-end picture.
Everybody's into visibility. You know how I'm always whining on about we don't have visibility into our networks. There's fundamentally four ways you can do it if you're focused on the endpoint. One is to put some code inside your app, and there's a whole bunch of startups who focus on when you write your app, put code in the app, you know, and then make API calls to a cloud service. The other one is network capture. You've got companies like MDACE and CPacket, and now Cisco with their Tetration. They capture packets in of a vast scale and then do analytics. You've got a class of products based around synthetic transactions. You've got Fluke Networks, for example, there with some hand edge probes. But what this is actually an agent-based model. This is the time-honored 20-year-old idea of you put an agent into your device, whether it's a smartphone or a Mac, you know, your Mac OS or your Windows platform, and that agent then puts its hooks into the operating system to see how the user's application is performing. Now, as you say, Riverbed made an acquisition of a product, one of the network monitoring, I think it was, I can't remember the name, and today it's called Steel Central App Response, which is agentless, that is network-based. It takes flow data and does and feeds it in so that you can do performance monitoring from the networking point of view. The problem is that as the data gets more and more encrypted, you're getting less and less functionality, and the network stuff doesn't always have the granularity that you need. So buying this app, agentless, agent-based technology is certainly going to be complementary and give the customer a choice of how they want to get visibility. So this drives Riverbed's load balancing product, you know, the WAN's acceleration. They had load balancing and stuff like that. They're now getting away from load balancing. They sold that off to Brocade, now focusing on this application performance, application delivery model, I think. That makes sense to you, John?
Yeah, it does. And I think you nicely laid it out that it comes down to, am I going to insert something into an application and use APIs, or am I just going to sit there and look at the pipe? And that becomes a very interesting dynamic, because if you've got the ability to look at what's going on from a network perspective, because I've got something running in the application, I can also maybe extend that out to look at, hey, how's my application running?
Yeah.
Independent of the network. So there's some other areas that could be interesting.
Again, this transition from appliances, WAN acceleration in the network, key points of control, very much about customer control and having a moat around your technology to prevent competition. And now you're trying to keep your product relevant by adding features to it, just the same as A10 did.
Yeah, and they have to do something to make things a little more interesting, because coming down the pipe is a whole lot of people looking at IoT, they're looking at machine learning, and they're thinking about taking massive amounts of data and being able to do a lot of things in real time. Because they've got this huge store of data, all this telemetry information happening in real time, and if you can do enough machine learning in the right places, you can really do some interesting stuff. So I think that's what the people who are already established and have products are running against time on, is they're trying to figure out, how do I stay ahead of that big wave that's coming? Because you know that machine learning is going to have all the big guys behind it. And you never like it when all the big guys start to get interested in your space.
Yes.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor. Mellanox Technologies has been a pioneer in high-performance interconnects for over 17 years. Mellanox recently introduced a revolutionary new Ethernet switch that is changing the shape of the modern data center. The SN2100 is the ideal top-of-rack switch with a high-density 19-inch side-by-side footprint, allowing maximum flexibility and enabling full rack connectivity to any server at any speed, from 10 gigabits a second to 100 gigabits. With unique benefits such as full redundancy in 1U, line rate performance for all ports at all packet sizes, full SDN support, and zero packet loss, the SN2100 delivers more than twice the benefits in half the footprint. And with flexible port speed configurations, all active out of the box, the SN2100 allows a variety of blocking ratios that suit any application requirement. Mellanox is so sure that the SN2100 is the perfect fit for your Ethernet network, they're offering a rich $4,000 rebate on the first switch purchase. Just visit mellanox.com/2100rebate or email them at offers@mellanox.com to start redesigning your data center today. And please tell them you heard about it on Packet Pushers. All right, back to the news. We had a note about Ericsson's Vestberg stepping down. There's a search for a new CEO. Greg, what's happening there?
So we've run out of product news this week. It's that time of year when conferences matter. But Ericsson's CEO stood down with immediate effect, which is not something that normally happens, but remains at the company's disposal. When I first saw this, I thought that's a really abrupt departure. I didn't know what was happening. Something went wrong. Somebody did something naughty? But I did some more research, and it turns out that apparently Ericsson's been persistently performing badly on the stock market, and they've been demanding better performance. The fingers are being pointed at Huawei and ZTE, who's undermining Ericsson in their core markets in Europe and Asia. And that seems to be the thing. They kicked out the CEO. He's going to carry the can and probably a very large can of money along the way out the other side.
That's right.
And that's what it is. It does highlight that the partnership that Cisco and Ericsson did recently, and we saw the Vestberg saying, oh, no, the partnership with Cisco is absolutely key to a way we're going forward. You got to wonder if the new CEO comes along and says, you know, Cisco just might eat my lunch and take all my customers. I'm not 100% sure. So watch out for that.
Yeah, that's what I would be most concerned about. When the Cisco-Ericsson partnership came up, the biggest thing that I thought is, you know, you have your Venn diagram and your overlap, and it happens to overlap in a lot of the areas that if I was Ericsson, I'd be worried about Cisco coming in and kind of taking over. And do you really want to give them a footprint in those areas?
Because they've been working with Juniper and Brocade to try and sort of make sure that they've got a portfolio there to keep bouncing them off and to meet what customers need. But I also hear that they've got rid of all of their routing products. So they've had a Redback routing that they bought like about 7 or 8 years ago, and they've been making their own routers and trying to make a success of that. But they've decided that that's not what they want to do and pushed all that out over the edge. It's all gone and in the bin, and then partnering with Cisco perhaps to replace that. Maybe it makes sense. Who knows? Time will tell, I think.
Yeah, I think if you take the position that you're going to get out of a market, you're basically leaving it open for your competitors to come in and take on what you're giving up. So you've got to have an alternative for your customers to keep them in your camp. And that may have been the least offensive option was, all right, we're going to move forward with Cisco, as opposed to just saying, you know what, we're out of the business. You guys go fend for yourselves.
And let's be partners. And that just means Cisco gives you some extra discount because you promised to buy more Cisco than you do Juniper.
Yeah. What they probably were asking for is just give us visibility to all the opportunities that are going on. As long as you know what's happening, we can stay on top of it. And I think the visibility was the biggest piece of this. It's very much a go-to-market piece. It's not as limited, or it's not as tied to product as you might think. Product was the catalyst for what happened, but it's more about a visibility to customers in my mind.
So Cisco goes into the deals with Ericsson instead of Ericsson running them on their own.
Right, or instead of Cisco going in on their own and Ericsson competing against Cisco, and as we would know, losing.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, it's financial reporting season, so we've got some notes from that field. First, we're going to start off with IBM. They reported their quarterly earnings. Good news for the company, they beat expectations, but their quarterly net income, not revenue, but income was down $1 billion compared to the same quarter last year. That's not so good.
It's hard to decode what IBM's doing, isn't it? It's selling this off and moving this around. And they had all of these unrealistic financial claims that they were going to, you know, Gianetti, the CEO, was promising that she was going to absolutely get IBM to this financial position. And she crucified everything to meet that goal and then ran short, ran out of fuel halfway down the track. So now it's all up in the air as IBM tries to turn itself into a cloud provider.
Well, they're doing not too bad there. The upside was their cloud business. They saw revenues go up 30% year over year to $3.4 billion, and IBM's predicting a run rate of $11.6 billion. But I think it's interesting the way they're, I guess they're counting what they say is cloud. So there's an IBM cloud service, which actually provides cloud services, but they're also counting software and hardware that they sell to customers for cloud projects as part of their cloud revenue. So that seems like a little bit of creative bookmaking.
Well, the next topic is, of course, that Amazon had a blockbuster quarter, and they're doing a $10 billion run rate. So you're telling me that IBM's cloud business is 20% larger than Amazon's?
It's got to be painful for IBM because they're like, wait, Amazon was an online bookstore 15 years ago, and we were a tech company 15 years ago, and now we're both essentially doing the same in selling cloud services. That's got to hurt a little bit.
I think you hit the nail on the head, though. It all comes down to how are you going to count it and what are you going to consider in there? Think about Amazon's cloud service. They don't sell the hardware per se, so they can only sell the service. IBM can sell hardware and service, and including Watson, and they can say, oh, well, Watson is cloud. Now I get to count that in my cloud revenue.
And you know, what about cloud printing? Is that in there too? I just get the sense that, you know, IBM needs to make cloud a thing. And if IBM's claiming, which if they're saying here, they've got a run rate of $11.6 billion, and Amazon's claiming a run rate of $10.5 billion, then it's fairly hard to chew on the idea that IBM's cloud business is bigger than Amazon's when that would not necessarily be true.
Yeah, I think a little bit of wishful thinking there. But let's move on. Greg, you also wanted to talk about Cavium's earnings.
Oh, Cavium. So it's announcement season this week. You should be very thankful that I didn't include all of them, so you will get more of them next week. But Cavium came in with its reporting this week, Q2 earnings per share of 29 cents, revenue of $100 million. It's just up over everywhere else. But as I was reading the CEO's comments to the stock analysts, he said, started talking about his cloud scale rack. Now, I wasn't aware of this, but apparently Cavium is building a full data center level solution using only Cavium data center technologies. So ThunderX based cloud servers, which is their ARM servers, XPliant based network switches, which is their ASIC silicon, and then end to end security enabled through Liquid Security and intelligent offload through Liquid IO, which is their network adapting network in NIC technology. So they're now out there selling an entire rack scale solution based around their own silicon, which I wasn't aware of. I mean, does this sound like hardware converged platform to you?
You know what it sounds like, if we're in a world where even Intel is having a hard time with customers biting off the idea of an Intel top to bottom rack scale solution, how does somebody like Cavium pull that off?
Exactly. Especially when you're running ThunderX, which is an ARM, right? A high speed ARM, don't get me wrong, it's not an x86 CPU. So that means that your entire build has to be running on ARM CPUs, and that's not entirely popular. But they claim they've got a couple of cloud companies who've bought this technology and partnered with Cavium. So maybe the pricing is right where you want it to be.
Yeah, but the real value, the real money in the market is not necessarily going after the cloud guys, because the cloud guys do a great job of negotiating the price. So you're going to make your money. You use the cloud guys to get into the market, and then you use everybody else to make your profit. So If Cavium is going to do a great job of getting at the cloud guys, but they can't get a footprint in the rest of the market, where does that leave them? I mean, their earnings have been flat for the last couple of years, not really going anywhere, not really exciting. They buy QLogic, who is not as exciting either and running the same kind of trajectory.
Yep.
So how do you supercharge the business when all you're doing is kind of plodding along at that same rate?
And they're also acquiring Microsemi. So they're going to get a wide range of secondary technologies from Microsemi too, which is interesting. But as you say, whether they can leverage that up to kick the bottom line, that's another thing. Jumping off to Juniper, Juniper got some results away this week. They did quite well in the sense that they met the expectations that the market has. A couple of things that I pulled out of the CEOs talking to the analysts again. Enterprise growth of 23% quarter over quarter. So enterprises, I might have speculated over the last couple of weeks that I didn't think Juniper was getting the interest of the enterprise IT, and yet they're seeing a growth of 23% over the previous quarter. And in particular, they said for switching data center strength across different customer verticals delivered revenue of $209 million, which is 10% year over year and 20% quarter over quarter. The bad news is that security business is expected to keep shrinking. They haven't worked out. They seem to have lost a bit of customer faith with the failure of the previous generation of firewalls, and the SRX is maybe a little bit, you know, not quite as everything that we did. So now Juniper, but to sort of keep itself in the market, the last thing that they did was that they partnered with Lenovo for building converged, hyper-converged stacks. So if you are about to buy a, you know, converged solution from Lenovo, you'll find that there's a Juniper switch inside of that product. So good for Juniper.
Yeah, good for Juniper, but I'm not too sure about the Lenovo converged. As I look at that, I think, you know, who's really the customer? Juniper's got a strong base in carriers. Lenovo's got a strong base in SMBs. So who's really the customer that buys that converged system based on those two platforms?
And so then we've got Radware. Radware came in this week, announced the results. You may not remember Radware for much, but except they do their load balancers, which are still very popular. They're doing okay. They've shrunk a lot. Their revenue is down 11.5% year over year, down to $50 million for the quarter. So they're not, but that's what they told the market. So things aren't bad, but obviously it's not as good as it wants to be. Radware's still struggling to find relevance as the market as it goes forward. And there's a bunch of other financial results, but I'm going to carry them over to next week because it gets a little boring if we do too many of them, Drew.
We don't want to do too many numbers this week.
No. And reading all those reports, and I'd go comatose after a while.
all that dull financial language is just, it's hard to wade through.
Oh, you've got no idea. And CEOs, they all say the same thing. After you read 5 or 10 of these in a day or two, you just sit there and go, like, kill me now. Everything's perfect. Our customers love us.
Fine.
Yeah.
I'm here to justify my exorbitant salary. It's great. Totally worth it. Every single penny.
And I'm not doing very good. Very well, I guess you should say.
Yes, indeed.
All right, that brings us to the end of this episode. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they get it?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters as @etherealmind. Hey, got a quick favor to ask. If you've got some time, would you head over to iTunes and leave a review? If you love the show, why don't you tell people how awesome it is? And if you don't love the show, then don't do that.
Yes, we'd appreciate that. Yeah. Say nothing if you have nothing nice to say. John, thank you for joining us for this episode. I hope it wasn't too weird. Where can folks find out about you?
They can find about me on Twitter at John Free, FRUEHE, or at More Insights and Strategies, MOOR, insightsstrategy.com.
Awesome, and we'll have those links in the show notes. I'm Drew Conrey-Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, or as Greg asked, leave a recommendation on iTunes. You can share this link with your colleagues and check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine, and Link Propagation. All those links are available on packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.